This is John Sayles, and I do a lot of things in the film world, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio.
Hey everybody, this is Adam Shartoff, your host of Film Wax Radio, and welcome to episode number 367 of the podcast. What a great episode we have today. Two segments. The first segment, jam-packed. This is a segment dedicated to composing film scores for horror films. How's that? And we're calling this segment Score to Death. This is actually based on a book from one of my guests, the returning Blake Fischera. Now, Blake has written a book. I say written, you could say it was edited and compiled, but it's faster to say he wrote it, which is a series of interviews with horror film score composers. And the book spans really generations of different musicians who have scored, who are known for scoring horror films. One of those composers joins Blake and myself today. His name is Jeff Grace. He has composed scores for Kelly Reichardt, for Ty West, for many others. And I'm really, really, really excited for his presence on the podcast. So we'll be talking to Blake and Jeff. And joining us via the miracle of telephone technology is the one and only filmmaker, actor, film producer, returning to the podcast for his third appearance, none other than Larry Fessenden, who also happened to write the foreword for Blake's book. Again, it's called Score to Death, and we're going to be talking about scoring for horror films and just, you know, film music in general, something I have, you know, really, truly, delinquently ignored on now, what, 360-some episodes of the show. I have no excuse. I extend my apologies to you if, A, you just love film soundtrack scores, etc., or if you are indeed a composer of any sort, you would say, hey, why hasn't this asshole dedicated any time on this show to music, film scoring? I mean, for Pete's sake, I'm glad to rectify the situation on some level, if not completely. So that is segment one with those gentlemen. And it's going to be a lot of fun. Let me just tell you, I produced the fuck out of this particular segment. I really put some time and effort into it. So I won't give away everything, but there's some fun stuff that occurs in this show. And then after that, you know, Jerry Lewis, huge icon for generations. The guy is now 91 years old. A few years ago, he shot a dramatic feature, a comeback, if you will. I think it hits theaters today as this podcast goes up. It's called Max Rose. It stars Jerry Lewis. It has a bunch of wonderful actors in it, including, if you can believe it or not, someone who was supposed to be on Film Wax Radio. That episode, the file was corrupt and I could never put it up. Kevin Pollak, that's one of the real, unfortunate moments in the history of the show. I lost my segment with the great Kevin Pollak. It also co-stars Mort Sahl, if you can believe it. I don't even remember him ever acting in a film, but here he is in his 90s as well, I believe. I'm not sure. Maybe he's on the cusp of 90s. Anyway, Mort Sahl is also in this movie. I wish he were on the show. But who is the director of the film, Daniel Noah. And he'll be joining us via telephone in the second segment from California. So you'll want to listen to that. Stories about Jerry Lewis, for God's sake. That was the idea. Okay, so Let's start the show. This episode also, I should mention, is sponsored by the Vermont College of Fine Arts. You know, they are a longtime sponsor of the show, and I'm very proud of that. Some episodes back earlier at the beginning of the spring, let's see, that would have been episode 348. I was at the Vermont College of Fine Arts. They were having their residency program. They invited me up there. I brought my kid, and we spent 4 or 5 days up in this beautiful area of Vermont. You know, we had a great time. They were treated really well. And during that week, I was able to meet up with three of the faculty members, Laura Colella, Jake Mahaffey, and Malik Vital. And we recorded segments for that episode, which you can go back and listen to if you feel inclined. So I'm proud to talk about the Vermont College of Fine Arts MFA in film. They offer a 2-year student design project-driven graduate program of professional mentorships, you know, three of which I just mentioned, three mentors, for your scripts, fiction, and nonfiction filmmaking and transmedia projects. Each semester begins with an on-campus residency week of screenings, workshop, lectures, and crits, along with the preparation of an independent study plan of your own personal projects. Then, students and faculty return home, and they work independently and meet monthly via Skype as projects unfold. The MFA program is designed to fit into the life you have and the films you make. Exciting, affordable, and intense. Refine your creative vision as you develop intensely personal stories and an independent practice. Visit vcfa.edu/film for more details. Again, thank you, Vermont College of Fine Arts MFA in Film, for sponsoring yet another episode of my little podcast here. We're coming from Brooklyn, New York. I am in the on a pretty street in Park Slope as I looking out the window. Finally, a cool breeze after a long, hot summer. It is September 1st. I'm working my ass off to get this episode up and out to you today because, you know, we have a show to do. So I'll be back after my conversations here, these two segments, to talk to you kind of about upcoming shows, who I'm talking with, what's going on. But for now, let's get into my conversation with Blake Fischera, returning to the podcast for his second visit to talk about his book, Score to Death, where he's joined by one of his interviewees, composer Jeff Grace, and, of course, the ubiquitous horror actor and filmmaker Larry Fessenden, back for his third appearance on the podcast. Thank you. And right now, let's get into it, my conversation with those gentlemen. Okay, we're in the Chopra Studios here in Lower Manhattan, and today I'm excited that we're going to talk about something which I've neglected, actually, and I apologize to all my hundreds of thousands of listeners, or as most people know it, my family, to talk about film composition. I mean, this is something I should have been talking about a long time ago, but the good news is we're doing it now, and what's great, the great timing is we can also promote Blake's book. Blake Fischera, I'm going to fuck up your name again. Remember last time it took me like 40 times?
Fischera.
Yeah, Blake Fischera, who's written a new book called Score to Death, which is, by the way, a fantastic title.
Yeah, a friend of mine came up with that.
You know, you could take credit. Well, unless the friend listens in. It's called Score to Death, which is really clever. Conversations with some, not all, of horror's greatest composers. So it's an interview format book. And the good news is we're also joined by one of the composers, Jeff Grace. Hi, Jeff.
Hello.
One of horror's greatest composers.
Well, it's very... And, you know, if that weren't enough, and I think at least one of us thinks it could have been, Larry Fessenden, who's been on this podcast, I think, two times already, two times too many, as far as he's concerned. Hi, Larry.
Hey, guys. Hey, Adam.
Larry, you wrote the foreword to this book. Just coincidentally, I opened it up today and I saw your name in it.
It's incredible. The coinky dink.
It is.
Blake got in touch with me. It was late in the game. I believe we were on a bit of a deadline. He just said, did I want to write something? And I was delighted to get a PDF of the material and glance through it and just found it very stimulating. They're really in-depth interviews, and that's what makes it special. It's not superficial. You get a real taste of each of the different interviewees, their approach, and it's really valuable. I think you're right that this isn't the most common topic. You know, we learn about makeup artists and obviously directors and writers, but we don't hear about the musicians, and really so many great films are, known because of their music, from The Godfather to Jaws to Bernard Herrmann and then Jeff Grace work as well.
Exactly. I'm a huge fan of the films that he has created. And, you know, I'm going to play the devil's advocate a little bit, which is a great expression for today, the devil's advocate. But, and that is like...
And what a picture.
Yeah, see? And, you know, I was talking to Blake before we got on the studio, and, you know, I can even admit that taking this for granted, that's why I've gone 360-some episodes in without doing a segment on film composition, because most people just take the music for granted. I guess that's kind of what you were just trying to say, right?
But I think at the same time, people will sort of reference the score, even the Christopher Nolan Batman. And as I said, most people know that Bernard Herrmann is creating that particular vibe that you get out of a Hitchcock movie. And I think, and the Tim Burton vibe is really associated with Danny Elfman. I mean,
sure.
Think of these directors, and they have their compatriots who really have done a great deal to put that stamp on the movies, which you just associate with the director.
Blake, when you were writing this book, obviously this was a subject that was really important to you and something you're crazy about, but did you think of the audience for the book? Do you think it's for, is this for the film community, or do you think this could go, this can transcend is the word I'm looking for. Yeah. Could this transcend to a more general audience? I mean, certainly horror film lovers, fanboys, genre film.
I mean, when I wrote it, it was more, I kind of wrote it for myself. I couldn't really find a book like it.
Mm-hmm.
I had
Well, that's called a diary.
I found some interview-based books about film scoring in general, and I found some essay-based books about horror music, but I didn't find, like, the horror composer's interview book. And a lot of the composer-oriented, like, interview books that I had read were very much based around music theory and stuff. And
so it was really even more inside baseball, you could say.
Yeah, I wouldn't
this
say.
This is more about...
Yeah. So my goal was really...
Origin stories and that kind of thing.
I mean, my goal was really to make a book that the fans of horror movies and the fans of horror movie music would like and be able to follow. But at the same time, talking to anybody about their process and the business in general, I feel like there is a lot of really valuable stuff mm-hmm. for people that want to be composers in the film business and that kind of stuff. So it was kind of, I guess I wrote it with both in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing about a more general audience, surprisingly, like very little of the book is about horror movies. You know, it is a lot of what's in there is kind of backgrounds about the composers and process, which is not specific to horror movies. I mean, we do talk about specific horror films and the way music works in horror films, but a lot of it is just about the art of film scoring.
Well, I do want to come back to the process and the common things you found about process, since that's a central thread that runs through all these interviews. We're here again with Jeff Grace, who is a fine composer of many of my favorite horror films. So thanks again, Jeff, for coming in, because this is great. What do you think in terms of the composer? Do you think it's a kind of an unsung role? I mean, I know you're very, very subjective.
Sometimes very much so. But in a way, I think that's kind of part of the job as well.
Yeah.
I mean, we talked about it in the interview. I think a composer's job is to kind of mm-hmm. bring the audience into the world of the film. And a lot of times that means without being noticed so much, you know, not hitting them over the head, at least. Occasionally you have to hit them over the head, but not usually. You don't want to do that. You don't want to draw too much attention to yourself. So if you're doing a good job, you're kind of flying under the radar in some respects.
Mm-hmm.
But like Larry was saying, I mean, I think especially when you have very effective scores or memorable scores and then director-composer relationships, then you start to, you know, people start to appreciate it a bit more. Yeah.
Alex, how does he sound, by the way? I'm sorry. He is a little low, right? I think he's talking right into the mic. I'm sorry, guys. One second. Can we turn him up a little or something? Or just because he's a little soft in my head. That's not you. I think it's the...
Is that good?
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Yeah, you're fine. So, Jeff, your filmography is great. You seem to work, which is probably typical, with repeat business is essentially what I'm trying to say. So I know you work a lot with Ty West, with Kelly Reichert, Jim Mickle, among others, and you know, it's amazing. What?
Larry.
Larry? Oh, Larry Fessenden. Yeah,
the other guy.
Of course. Well, Larry's produced almost all those, right? Like, or at least had a hand in.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we did the radio. He's got a radio show that we
did. Oh, right. Together. You did the music. Did you do the music to all of the
Tales Beyond the Pale?
Tales Beyond the Pale.
I did the theme music, and then I did a number of the episodes, at least in the first season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Larry,
I always joke that Jeff just pulled that theme. I think I asked him almost as a favor, and it's probably the most used piece of music you've ever created.
Right? You're saying you use it all the
time.
We can
have a conversation about that later, Larry. No, just kidding.
Yes.
Process. Blake, what did you find out about process maybe that you weren't anticipating? Or maybe what is a very common thread about all the process from, you know, since you have how many composers you interviewed?
14.
14 different. Were there any others that you didn't include that you're sitting on?
No.
Bonus features?
I mean, there were people I would have loved to talk to, but they just didn't work out. If we ever do a volume two, maybe we'll get to talk to some of them too. But I'm really pleased with the kind of variety that of composers that are in the book, which was kind of really on my mind when I was trying to come up with who I wanted to talk about. I mean, who I wanted to talk to. I wanted to get kind of different age groups.
Sure.
And different backgrounds.
Right.
And some of the guys are from Italy. And,
right.
And stuff like that.
So, right. The Dario Argento school.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. So since you bring it up, or we brought it up, just a handful I'll mention here is Simon Boswell, John Carpenter, who I didn't know until I knew when I was reading the book that he scored his own films. I don't know why. Didn't know that. Jeff, of course. Tom Hajdu? How do you pronounce it? I think it's Hajdu.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm asking. Yeah, because
he's part of a composing team called Tom and Andy.
Oh, I see. I actually have a collection of his music, which is written for, like, old porn themes, I believe. I, of course, didn't purchase that. It was given to me. Harry Manfredini. Did I pronounce that right? Yeah, Harry Manfredini. And others, et al. So it's really a comprehensive book for anybody who's interested in film composition at all, let alone horror film. And if you're a fan of horror films, perfect reading for you.
Yeah.
And Jeff, just tell the story how you got to, was it almost incidental in the sense of you were just sort of already a musician, right? You grew up a musician.
Yeah.
And you got hired by what's the composer? Howard Shore's company?
Yeah. Yeah, I was his assistant for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you weren't planning on going into film composition. You just ended up getting a job. You needed a job, I guess, or maybe a better job than you already had?
Well, I wanted, I went to school. I didn't go to like a film scoring program. I just went to a regular music program. I studied composition and I studied performance. Mm-hmm. And then I met a guy who had a friend who owned a music house in the city, and you know, they did like jingles and mm-hmm. stuff for TV and whatever, and I'd never really thought about it, but that mm-hmm. so I was like, oh, that's a job.
And you were pretty young, so
yeah. So I grew up with, you know, like the soundtrack to Star Wars and all. I mean, every kid I knew had that,
right?
And all kinds of other things. But then it really occurred to me that I should get a job, and that was a possibility. So I ended up working there, and then I started scoring films, like for students at NYU and SVA and Columbia.
Roughly, what years would that be?
Late '90s.
Okay.
I think 2000. Yeah, I met late 2000. I met Howard, and I started working up there. So Lord of the Rings, Gangs in New York.
Never heard of those. Sorry.
We did David Cronenberg's Spider. We did that.
I don't remember that one.
That's a smaller one with Ralph Fiennes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And Panic Room, mm-hmm. David Fincher.
Oh, sure. So pretty big stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it was a great, you know, I was there 3-4 years, got to work on all the top studios and stuff.
It's amazing opportunity, right?
Yeah, and to see, what was really great about that was seeing seeing the way one composer interacts with these different directors, you know, and oh, oh yeah. great directors, right, right. you know.
But he was also, I'm sorry, go ahead, Jeff.
Well, there's just a lot of stuff that, you know, when you go and you, when you watch a film and you listen to the score in the film, you don't know what the conversations between the filmmakers mm-hmm. were and between the composer and the director. And, you know, you don't, you have no idea about any of that stuff.
Sure.
And so to kind of be a fly on the wall for that stuff was very interesting.
And that must have helped tremendously as you're evolving into your own role of composer.
Yeah, I think a composer, you kind of figure, you know, everybody's different, right? And it's just like creative choices that you're doing all the time. And everybody makes different choices, and that's what makes you you. For me, it was a matter of figuring out, like, oh, this person does this, and let me try that. And okay, that thing, yeah, that's really great. I like that's something that's useful for me, then that works for me. And then other things might not work as well for you, or you can't pull them off the same way as that person does. And so over time, and that was the other great thing about working with Howard, was I just met a lot of other composers mm-hmm. like on a very, that were working on a very high level. And then you just, so over time and their assistants, and you learn how different people work and they do things and how they approach things. And
hello.
Yeah, what was that?
I don't know.
So that was all really great. It was kind of, you know, it's like pulling back the curtain and mm-hmm. you see things. Right. There's things you don't even know to ask until you see.
You don't know what you don't know.
Exactly.
So yeah. You know, it's interesting because there's a handful, I think, of celebrity composers. Certainly Howard Shore would fall in there. And Larry mentioned Danny Elfman. There's, you know, of course, John Williams and a bunch of others. Mostly male-dominated, as I think about it.
Hans, that's Hans.
Yeah, mein Kommandant, continue. What were you saying? Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you knew my nickname. What were you saying? Hans?
Hans Zimmer.
Hans Zimmer, of course, among others. And I imagine their experience is different. Like, you know, they're huge, and so people are, you know, they're coveted. Like, if I could get Howard Shore, you know, this is going to be a dream. Now, but the good thing about when you entered, you know, the next phase is all of a sudden there's this resurgence of all these kids coming out making these horror films, which were definitely homages in some cases to 80s horror. But all of a sudden there seems to be this whole generation, roughly your age, maybe slightly, I don't know, and all of a sudden you're in demand.
Yeah, well, and part of that was thanks to Larry.
He's on my payroll. No, I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay.
No, I met Larry, producer friend of ours, Peter Polk. I met Peter, I think, at an IFP, you know, Independent Feature Project, mm-hmm. Some kind of event they were having. I met him when I was getting ready to leave Howard's, and then he called me sometime later saying, hey, I'm producing this film for this young director, Ty West, and that ended up being The Roost, which is
his first
feature film, yeah. And Larry, one of the many films of his that Larry produced, and that's how I met Larry, and then from there, we just started doing a lot of stuff together, and then I think the next thing I did with them was Larry's movie, The Last Winter.
Mm-hmm. All these filmmakers have been on my show. Kelly's been on. And Larry, of course, several times. And Jim Mickle and Ty West has been on in a couple of months when Vitten Valley of Violence comes out. So I'm saying that retroactively, or maybe that's not the right term. Larry, you're going to help me get Ty on, right?
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
We all can control Ty. Yep, we tell him what to do.
Okay, yeah. Because, you know, he's like, I'm going to be nervous, I think, around him because... I'm such a fan. You know, he's, I think, The Innkeepers and the House of, oh my God, The House of the Devil. You know, I had Tom Noonan on, and I said to him, you really carry this movie, don't you? And he reminded me, he's like, I'm not in 80% of it. I disappear for like 80% of it. I'm like, well, that's how, you know, great an actor I think you are. So,
well, it's funny because, of course, Tom Noonan was our big ace in the hole when we made The Roost.
I thought that was Jeff Grace. Rex, oh, you're ahead of me. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, no, it was a big deal. We had this concept that we'd make these low-budget films, but we'd get something that would tie it to, you know, the history of horror and some sort of exciting component. And in that case, it was Tom Noonan. He's the horror host of The Roost. There's sort of a wraparound story. And actually, Jeff has some fun organ music there. Most of that score is very Penderecki style, strings, slashing strings. But then there's some quite funny intro music for the horror host, played by Tom Noonan.
Oh, right. He's a musician. He's
saying that the music that plays under this the host bit is it's like this organ.
Oh, that he's playing.
Well, it just plays when he's on the screen.
Oh, I see. And he's got his own like.
Yeah, and that's theme kind music. Of a set because or, narratively that's like saying. A wraparound for the story.
Sure.
So that's completely different than the rest of the film and the rest of the score. Yeah. But
I want to go back and see it again, but I'm too terrified. I mean, it's seriously one of the scariest movies. I mean, you fucked Greta Gerwig up big time. You fucked her up. I'm like, that's just wrong. I mean.
Oh, for House of the Devil?
House of the Devil now.
Yeah.
Yeah. What were you thinking of?
Oh, yeah. She got shot in the head.
Yeah. That was just
spoiler point. Alert.
yeah, exactly. This part could come out. I want to ask you a question, Jeff, and also, you know, Blake, jump in. Blake Fischera. Oh, by the way, we're talking about Blake's book. It's called Scored to Death, Conversations with Some of Horror's Greatest Composers, which is currently available where books are sold. I got my copy from the publisher, so what can I tell you guys? But I know this is available also on, obviously, all the Amazons and Barnes & Nobles of the world.
Yes, yeah. It is very available. Buy in bulk.
But buy a bunch of them. They make lovely gifts. You know, get a head start. Halloween is around the corner.
Perfect book for mom.
Blake, just also say you've got a couple of appearances coming up, too. I know one is really soon, so that probably I won't get the show up in time, but you're also going to Burbank? When's that?
August 21st.
Maybe I could aim for that then.
Maybe I'll be in Burbank at Dark Delicacies Bookstore.
Okay.
Doing a signing, and a number of the composers in the book who are on the West Coast are going to be there with me.
So that's
fantastic. It should be a great time.
Yeah. Is there a community there? Do you guys like all hang out and have pizza and like, you know, scream at each, like hide behind doors and,
Jeff,
and yell Jeff's, at each other? And
Jeff's
you know,
the only person I spoke to who's here on the East Coast. But it seems that everybody on the West Coast knows each other pretty well.
I
had dinner with some of them and, you know, Joseph Bashara was like, Nathan emailed me today and, you know, like he can't show up and that, like they all seem to know each other pretty well. And, and even though it's, you know, they span ages and stuff, I guess you guys probably do a lot of festivals and conventions and stuff like that. I think they probably get.
Yeah. When you meet, I mean, people
you know, when you're working cool. in the same kind of thing, you know, you tend to cross paths, I would assume.
I have a couple of questions about choices made as a very green listener, somebody who doesn't really know a lot about composing. I mean, I've been a songwriter, a musician myself, but I've never scored anything. So, but I noticed, of course, that there's a plethora of church organ music on, as we already mentioned, is very common. Any thoughts about, or a lot of choral music in Latin often?
You mean in horror scores? In
yeah, I'm sorry. I thought that, yeah, in horror film scores. What's that about? Jeff, have you ever used those tropes?
I think the only time I've used the organ thing is probably that thing that Larry was talking about with the roost.
Mm-hmm.
And the choir thing, I probably...
Oh, he was in the roost. That's what it was before. Tom Noonan was also in the roost?
He was in the roost and he was in House of the Devil.
I forgot. Okay, I'm sorry.
But the...
Just catching up, Larry. Just slow. Jesus.
There was a little bit of choir in... House of the Devil. I mean, The Innkeepers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's it.
Well, and just in
and
the
that, you know, that's like that's a ghost story. So it's
yeah.
kind of
makes
know,
sense. The Gregorian
we
is another
full traditional on that one.
But know. There's a lot, and we're going to get to a segment within this segment in a moment where I'm going to test you guys. This is a surprise. I'm ambushing you all. Larry, you can participate as well. It's a little game show thing. I'm going to play a few clips, and we're going to see. who can name the film first?
Larry. Oh,
okay. Well, Larry's
gonna. Yeah, I'll be terrible. No, Larry will be great.
These are actually not so hard. Most of them are yours, actually. So you should get them real quick.
I won't know. I definitely won't know. No, but to get back to what you were saying about the organ and the choir thing, I think that just the whole liturgical thing.
If sure,
you know. With all the demonic things and that kind of stuff, then, it's an easy one to go to.
It is easy. But speaking of which, you also will notice, I was like watching this new show, which is now everyone is talking about, called Stranger Things. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's on Netflix. It's an original.
I've heard of it, yeah.
And it's a horror series, and they lean on synth music.
Yeah, it's very – in the way music is very kind of Carpenter-esque.
Yeah.
Which is kind of becoming a thing.
Yeah, is it done ironically? Is it or like as a homage?
I think it's definitely an homage. I mean, takes place in '83.
Sure.
It's very much a big plug for Stranger Things. Very much trying to play homage to the Spielberg produced stuff in the '80s, like Poltergeist.
My understanding is that the entire show is almost shot for shot or moment for moment an homage. So
yes,
I'm sure the composer was instructed to evoke those kinds of scores as well.
Yeah, in other words, this is no disrespect to the composer of Stranger Things, but it seems like it's packaged. It's all packaged. So you're kind of I get that sense too. We're tapping into this a certain Spielberg.
I just think it's going for a certain tone that's very nostalgic for a time period. So I think the music is just part of that. I mean, it's the music has been being talked about a lot, like online and stuff. I mean, mm-hmm. People love the music, and I love the music too. I mean, it's one of the reasons why I wrote this book is because I have nostalgia for these kinds of scores and especially the music.
But let me ask about this now in a slightly more nuanced way, which is, I know it comes as a surprise to you, don't think I can do such a thing, but what is it about the synth music then that we now interpret as creepy? I mean, I guess it's always contextual. I mean, you can listen to synth music and be considered a kind of a, upbeat type of up-tempo or whatever. I don't know. And I'm now watching it. I have an association. And when I listen to synth music on a score, I'm always now thinking this is a horror film. And I'm just wondering why it's creepy now.
I think that Carpenter was really effective at, taking like a minimalist approach to things. And he's, I think it's in your book, but I've also heard him talk about this before, that basically that's he's just like working within the confines of his abilities.
Interesting.
But what he does, very similar to what Bernard Herrmann did, is he takes these little melodic ideas and works them in various ways but really, really hammers away at them, and it kind of gets under the skin of the audience. And I think he's, in that way, he's very effective. He's just using a different sound palette than, say, Bernard Herrmann did. Mm-hmm. I mean, Bernard Herrmann was really the guy who just took those little melodic fragments and harmonic ideas, simple harmonic ideas, and then just really, really worked them. And very, very effectively. But he's the guy, that really brought that to the fore and showed how effective you can be with that.
I also think the synth thing probably came out of necessity of budget and stuff when it kind of started. Carpenter talks about it specifically, a lot of these, especially in the 70s and the 80s when a lot of this started with the synth music, I mean, these were lower budget films. And even though obviously there were budgets, like Harry Manfredini with Friday the 13th, he didn't. I mean, there's maybe some synth stuff in there, but he used a string ensemble and stuff, I think. Mm-hmm. But I think it kind of came out of a way of working cheaply, but also effectively. And Carpenter talks about it specifically. He found that the synth he could build by multi-tracking and get a bigger sound, but with just him and a keyboard. So I think that's probably where it comes from. But, Tangerine Dream and the stuff that they did with Michael Mann and Wayne Friedkin that wasn't necessarily horror-based, it's just very much of the time.
Sure.
And
Yeah, I think with them, in the case of them, I mean, that was a very specific sound that it, that people went to them for.
Yeah, I didn't
sound.
Mean to imply that they were cheap, but I was just saying it wasn't. My point was that it wasn't specific to horror music. I mean,
right.
It was specific more to 80s.
I'm just saying that in that particular case, because I think you nailed it with Carpenter. That he, I mean, he's said that, and I've read him say that in other interviews as well. That it's like it was his ability, and he was what he was working with. You know?
Yeah.
But then there's the case when, you know, it's like whenever you get some musical artist to do something,
sure.
Then the case of Tangerine Dream, that's like even Risky Business, you know, I mean, that's Tangerine Dream, or you know,
well, then even like Goblin, you know, a band that has a very specific sound, and if that's what you want, I mean, that's you go to those guys for it.
But I think nowadays that it is the nostalgia thing that people are kind of an homage thing that people are sort of going back to.
Well, those who grew up in the 80s are now in their late
40s.
But
even your score for Cold in July has been compared to that.
Sure. You know, and the funny thing about I actually wrote, Jim had me write some music, I think, while they were shooting, or maybe just before, a little before they shot. Mm-hmm. I wrote like a few themes. And then, and a lot of that was more, originally he was thinking like sort of guitar based Texas kind of stuff, because it takes place in Texas in the 80s. And then we had a conversation about, oh yeah, well maybe we'll try some synth stuff too. And then just by taking that same exact material and just putting synths on it, it just went there.
Yeah,
it went to like the Carpenter place, you know. Yeah. But it wasn't. It was almost all those themes were written before on different instruments, and then it didn't. I don't think anyone would have thought, oh, that Carpenter, until you put those sounds there. You know,
got that tone, the Carpenter tone.
Yeah, exactly right.
The preset. On the keyboard.
That's right. Dial up the Carpenter.
Also, I know from reading the book, there's it seems to be, since vinyl, which never really went away, is definitely become very popular again, owning a vinyl collection.
Yeah.
The horror film scores have found a place in there that there's a popular format, right?
I think it kind of started as a fad and then just like went past being a fad, and now it's just like a full-blown thing. Limited edition releases, some of Jeff's scores even.
Even Jeff's scores.
You know, it's just like it's a wide variety. I mean, it's meaning even a more contemporary scores, not just classics.
Right.
Because I think it kind of started with the 70s and the 80s and stuff. But the interest is a big thing for collectors. I mean, I started doing it while I was writing the book because I ended up finding it to be like a really valuable resource. Because it was, in some cases, it was maybe the only way to get some of these scores to listen to. And they're cool, so why not?
Larry, you've directed how many films? How many features?
What's that?
Sorry, Larry. Wake up. How many? Just kidding. No, you've been neglected. How many films have you directed? Features, like four or five? How many? Directed.
Something like that, yeah.
Do you have any? Are there any scores of the existing?
Any scores of what?
Do you have, like, the soundtracks? Are there soundtracks for them? Like
all of them, yes. And they're quite different. I had a wonderful composer for a movie called Wendigo, Michelle Debussy, and she brought in lots of exotic instrumentation because of the Native American theme of the Wendigo. And that was a very exciting score. And then obviously with Jeff, we wrote some wonderful things for the last winter. I've had a strange experience on two of my films. I had two composers. One that was doing a more soundscapey type of thing, and one that was doing more melodic stuff. And with last winter, I had a composer who did some more synthy things. And from Jeff, I wanted orchestral pieces that spoke to the romanticism of the film. So, and then Habit, we also had a string quartet. I've always tried to get in the studio and use live instruments. I feel it gives a certain texture. Obviously, my kid just made a movie and he did the score, and we were doing a lot of synth beds and really having fun with that. So every movie calls for a different vibe. It's really fun. I absolutely love the musical part of a film. I know that it's ultimately going to almost identify the movie, and so I take it very seriously and have enjoyed my collaborations with the musicians. And then Jeff and I did something, it was for TV, and actually in a way I'm very proud. We were really on a no fuss, no muss agenda. I asked Jeff for some scenes while I was shooting, so I had that wonderful experience of actually temping with my actual score, which is very unusual because of the way you make a film. You don't always have that luxury. And I think it's because we had to shoot so quickly. This was a show called Skin and Bones for NBC, and Jeff whipped up the score. It was wonderful.
Yeah, that was
very
atmospheric. That was for a series called Fear Itself, which was like a porting over of Showtime
Masters of Horror.
Yeah.
Oh, it's okay. Showtime.
So they did one season on NBC. Yeah.
Oh.
2008. Summer, I think. Yeah.
Larry mentioned that on the one project he had two different. He's working with two different.
The Last Winter. He said. Yeah. You said there was another film. Larry was that for No Telling?
No Telling. I had David Van Tegum, who's actually renowned sort of performance percussionist, and he was really excited to do this sort of synthy, moody, if you will, almost the horror score. But then in the same way, I always am torn because I make horror films, but I have a romantic soul. So I wanted my friend to write these more soaring Peter Greenaway type of instrumentations. And so there I had the two. I figured out how to credit them, but they both supplied different types of music. That was for No Telling.
I was wondering when you mentioned that, maybe Jeff, you can answer this question, is how closely would a composer work with a sound designer or editor? Maybe it's different in every film. So.
It's different. It depends on the filmmaker. It depends on a lot of different things. When you come on the project. Ty is very, very good friends, childhood friends with his sound designer, Graham Resnick. All the films I've done with Ty, Graham's been there before I even got on. And so we work very closely together. And in fact, Graham actually, he's a good composer himself, and he's a very, very good director himself as well. Great writer. So he sometimes even does some electronic music for Ty's films as well, like additional music kind of stuff. And so they're
trying to crowbar his way in.
That's right.
Got to step on him like a bug. I know what I'm saying, Jeff.
Yeah, I found out too late, so. so he's a very good sound designer, and that's, for Ty, to him, sound is a huge part of a film's, the audience's experience of a film. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, they're very closely related. Sometimes we will send stuff back and forth, So he may have a bed of something, and then I might write a cue on top of that, or I might write something, and then Ty may want some kind of thing to go around that. Sometimes in the case of something like The Innkeepers, where it was a part of the narrative, when they're on the headphones.
Oh, right.
And they start hearing things that when you don't have the headphones on, you don't hear them. And then when you have the headphones on, you start these things. So there's there's a Chopin piano piece that plays. And then of course, so there's the stuff that's diegetic, and then that was all woven in with the sound design. And then there's there's score stuff as well for some of that. So it's very closely related. But then there's other times where it's kind of, you're working in isolation, or you have to work very, very quickly,
right,
and there's no time for back and forth.
Sure. And you love those times.
Oh, yeah. That's,
in and out.
Oh, yeah. That's real.
Well, let's go to this game I put together. It's called Check Your Horror Score IQ.
Okay.
For cleverly enough. Now, these are going to be pretty straightforward, I have to say, because my own knowledge is rather limited. And we have listeners, so, you know, we want to give them let them at least have some sort of access to this stuff. So I'm not going to go too obscure here. We'll start with a couple of easy ones. I'm going to play a tune. Larry, you're going to participate, right?
Yeah, I will try. I'm not a film geek, though.
Oh, I get it. No, you don't have to be. These won't be too tough. We'll start with a couple of easy ones, in fact. Okay?
Jaws.
I don't know what you're talking about. We're doing this sort of old world, not like,
old
we're
world.
Not,
you mean you're going to give us the answers first, and then we're going to go?
Well, no, I was going to say I'm playing them on vinyl. No, okay, here we go. This is okay, Larry. This is for you. Hold on. Here we go. Okay.
Am I getting punched? Yeah.
Okay,
that's 60 Seconds of Silence by John Cage.
Did you not hear any of that?
No.
Oh.
It's 3 minutes and four.
Did everybody else hear that? Not Larry?
I heard it. Yeah.
Larry, one more time. I'm going to play something else because that was actually Jaws. But hold on. Sorry, Larry. If we can't figure this out, you might have to step out. Hold on. You should be able to hear this, though. Hold on one second. Actually, I want to see if you can hear this, Larry. One second. Here we go. Larry, did you hear that?
Well, that is Jaws.
Right. Okay. So long. Yes, it is. You stepped on my first one. I was going to give like a giveaway, like, you know, an easy one, but that you know that was funnier what you did. Okay. So here's another one. This one shouldn't be too hard for you guys.
Well, Adam, yeah. You have to laugh. That was the other joke I made.
Oh.
What's Psycho?
Okay, very good. Now, can you name the composer for extra credit?
John Williams and then Bernard Herrmann.
Okay, show off. All right,
and then
good.
Can you name what pieces they were ripping off?
Well, in this case.
What is it, the planets? No, that's Star Wars. What's the answer?
The first, Jaws? I think that's right, spring, right?
Jaws is Sacre du Printemps by Stravinsky.
Is that true?
That's correct.
Oh, wow. So they actually have, like, referenced...
It's clearly influenced by that.
I thought you were going to say... Who then did Fantasia? Fantasia, the Mickey Mouse... You know, that's all Sacre du Printemps, I think.
That's something mountain, right, Jeff? But let me tell you a silly story. So when I was little, I loved Jaws so much that I built a Jaws boat and I filmed it. And I used the Stravinsky instead of the Williams.
By accident.
And I guess it's not that good a story. You'd have to see it, though.
It is good. And we do want to see it. Let's go to the videotape. Wait a minute. I can't do that. It's a podcast. I'd love to see that. You still have something like that hanging around? Come on.
Of course. It's online somewhere.
Is it really?
Sure. Okay. If you go to IMDb and you look up Jaws, there are two versions.
Oh.
One by Spielberg and one by me.
Very good.
There's no shark, though, but it was a low-budget picture.
I can't wait to see it. I'm serious. Okay, here's another one. This should be pretty straightforward. So don't get nervous, Blake. You look like you're sweating a little bit. Okay, here we go. Okay. That's a clue right there. Because everybody repeats that part.
That's the clue.
Okay. Nobody wants it. It's too easy for everybody.
Well, it's Friday the 13th.
Thank you.
Harry Manfredini. And he talks about in the book how people compare that piece to Bernard Herrmann. And he's like, well,
I love that.
You know, and everybody's like, and his mentality is, if you are, then I did a good job. Like, I'll take it.
Of course, you can see playing them back to back like that. Yeah. It's certainly evident. Okay, I'm going to go a little bit harder now, at least as far as the listening audience is concerned. Maybe this is a little bit more obscure, just a little bit more.
Thank you.
It's beautiful.
Well, yes.
Yeah, we made reference to it, so.
Yeah, it's Suspiria.
I know these Goblin. Are very easy, but come on, it's for the
but,
audience.
Yes. Yeah, I mean.
Who wrote that one?
A band called Goblin, Italian band.
Okay.
Probably their most famous.
You talk about that in the book, in the intro to the book, right?
See, yeah. These are all opportunities for you to plug your book.
In a lot of ways, the inspiration of the book came from my going to a Goblin concert and realizing that a band who was still, I mean, thought of as being obscure in the mainstream sense, but never had the popularity to even come into America in their heyday, which was the 70s. Now, all these years later, can tour the world and fill houses.
Now? Even now?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because of this resurgence of, like, this love for horror music. Right. And being in that concert, seeing just, like, this group of people being totally into the show was just, like, man. Like,
who else is
and I go? Went and I was like, I want to read about Goblin, but because they're Italian, there's not really much to read other than like Wikipedia, and so that's in a lot of ways that's where the inspiration for the book itself came from, being at a Goblin show.
Speaking of Italian, you mentioned also before when we were hanging out that you said there's one composer, one of the Italian composers who you had an email with, right? And he sent you. Over the phone.
And talked to the person over the phone was with Fabio Frizzi, who is an Italian composer who is best known for his work with the director Lucio Fulci. I think it was because of the language barrier. He didn't want to do it kind of as an audio interview. So I was allowed to submit a number of questions via email. And then he told me I would get them by a certain time. That time came and went. And I was like, am I going to... Can I get the answers to these questions?
Yeah, I've spent all of my advance already. I got to get this book done, you know?
And then he was basically like, I don't have time to do them. But so what he did was he sent me an audio recording.
Oh, an audio.
In Italian, like an MP3 of him answering my questions in Italian. And then I had to go and hire a translator. And then the first translator kind of stunk, so then I had to hire another translator. Because the only budget of the book went from went into the translation of this 6-page interview.
That's funny. All right, let's get back to more importantly to the game show here. Okay, I'm going to try to find one that's a little harder. Here we go. Okay. You don't know it? You must know it. Oh, see, there's that Bernard Herrmann influence mixed with the Latin choral stuff, though. Anybody?
Is that the
Larry? Go ahead. Anybody?
I can't hear it, but is it the Omen?
Yes.
Yeah. That's pretty good. Dude, I can't even hear it.
Oh,
you
can't even
hear.
I don't know why you can't hear it. Maybe
another one of your earlier. So
it's called the track is called actually Ave Satini, which I think is a really funny name. Satini, like it's so unsubtle. Jerry Goldsmith.
I think that was the only
celebrity
score that he got an Oscar for, right?
That I don't know.
We'll take your word for that. Okay, last one. Well, let's just this one I know that Jeff will get because I think he talked about it in his interview with.
That doesn't mean I'll get it.
Okay, here we go.
Lord of the Rings.
No, but it's one of Larry's favorites also.
I can't understand why Larry can't hear this.
In fact, Larry talks about this in the foreword.
All right, that's enough, since you know what it is.
Larry, were you able to hear that?
Nope.
Oh, it's turning into Wendy Carlos score for The Shining.
Exactly.
Oh, The Shining.
Yeah, I'm going to hold it up to my mic. There's no reason why you shouldn't be able to hear that. I can't technically understand why. Anyway, okay, and finally, I do want to end with some. Those are all movies that probably the most recent one is 30 years old. So I'm going to end with this more contemporary one, and if you could... Let's see who knows it. I'm going to hold it up to my mic now, my speaker, Larry, so maybe you should be able to hear this, I think.
Okay.
Because it's not fair. Yeah, I don't know how you got the Omen. You couldn't even hear it.
You said choral. That's all.
That's incredible. You're just a dynamo. Hold on. Say again?
It Follows?
Correct. Correct. Do you know the composer?
No, I'm sorry, I don't.
It's okay. It's okay. He's got the great handle. He uses
what is it? Disaster piece.
Correct. Disaster piece. AKA Richard Vreeland. Okay, so I think, you know, this is split evenly among everybody. Everybody did really well. So your what is it? The prize, the parting gifts? It's you don't have to come back on the podcast ever again, and I don't think anybody can top that. Consolation, that's what I was saying. Consolation prize. That's for losers, right?
That's for the second.
That's for the loser to console
place.
Them as they leave the.
Yeah, it's the second place. Prize,
right, it's a consolation.
Got a 6-pack of beer or something.
Yeah, you, Larry, very good by the way. But
thank
it is
you.
It is odd that you got as many correct when you couldn't hear them, but.
I'll be honest. I was just on your wavelength. I actually didn't know if that was It Follows, but I suspected that that was the right one to choose.
See, that's
when you said you had a modern score. The guy who programs for TIFF,
yeah, I know them. Mm-hmm.
To Toronto International Film Festival, he says that half the movies were temp scored with It Follows. So it's definitely the current favorite horror score, I'd say.
Well, I am going for stuff that's more accessible because, you know, I doubt many people that might be listening in know there's truly, truly more obscure ones, right?
Yeah, but I mean, I'm a fan of the stuff that's celebrated and that is iconic, so there's nothing wrong with, choosing the stuff that really lasts.
Right, no, and it really is a good, I mean, I love that movie. I thought that was really well done.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, winding down here, thank you everybody for coming in and really putting up with all this. I know it's not easiest thing to schedule everything when there's so many moving parts to it, so I really do appreciate it, everybody's flexibility. We've been talking about Blake Fischera's book, Scored to Death, Conversations with Some of Horror's Greatest Composers, one of whom, wait for it, Jeff, I don't know why I did that. Jeff Grace is here, and Larry Fessenden, who wrote the foreword to the book. With all that's going on with Glass Eye Picks, anything you want to mention, by the way, while we're on the subject of Glass Eye Picks, Larry? Anything coming out? Anything new? Anything exciting?
No, just same old crap. But do come visit the website, glasseyepicks.com, and see what we're up to. We've got some stuff.
Now in its fourth decade. Did I make that up? You had like a big anniversary. I don't remember. Was it 30 years?
No, you're absolutely right. It was our fourth decade.
Well, I'm saying you're now started your fourth decade. The day after the 30th anniversary is the beginning of your 40th decade. No?
Making crap for over 30 years. That's our motto.
That's a great motto. I love it.
Yeah. On a budget. On a budget.
Making cheap crap
for over 30 years.
Jeff, we have a Valley of Violence. Ty West's new film's coming out in October, so you'll have your name all over that, and hopefully they'll be selling vinyl copies of the score in the lobby.
Hey, that'd be great.
Of various theaters, I'm sure it's going to be
fantastic. Which, score, by the way, another notch in Jeff's belt.
No doubt. And that stars the actor Ethan Hawke, right?
No, it stars Larry Fessenden.
Oh,
Ethan
Hawke. My bad.
With supporting players, John Travolta and Ethan Hawke.
That's correct.
John who? Okay. And Blake.
He's an old timer. We threw him a bone.
Yeah, it was nice of you. I got to get time on the show now. I purchased John Travolta. And it's a Western meets. Quasi-horror?
It's a Western. It's got some intense, pretty violent moments in it.
Okay.
And it's got an awesome dog.
Oh, I can't wait to see it.
Awesome dog.
Blake, you have not only a brand new book, but you also have a podcast you co-host.
I do.
Okay. In fact, we did an episode or segment some months ago with you and your podcast co-host, and this is called Saturday Night Sleepovers.
Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers.
Movie Sleepovers, which is a great podcast. Search for it on whatever your podcast app is, whether it's iTunes or Stitcher or one of the others. You'll find it. It's there. And you should check it out because it's a lot of fun. Larry, you should check that out, by the way.
I look forward to it.
Sounds like two guys drunk and just sick on pizza, talking about their favorite movies they grew up on. It's a lot of fun. And did you have any more scores, by the way, Jeff? I cut you off. I apologize. Any other movie projects coming out that you're participating in?
We got the second season of Happen Leonard, Jim Mickle's show.
Oh, okay.
That'll be
what is that playing on?
That's on the Sundance Channel, and it airs on AMC as well.
Oh.
That will be they're shooting in the fall, so you know, look for it late winter, early spring, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's Kelly Reichert's. Her film Certain Women mm-hmm. will be coming out, I think. Larry, you know when that comes out, like October or something?
Certain Women will be out in, right after the New York Film Festival.
Right.
So
I was going to mention.
September, October.
It's going to be at the New York Film Festival.
Yes.
And Larry,
and then I think it opens right away.
Right. Are you producer on that, Larry?
I was indeed, yep.
Congratulations.
I tried to get a different composer, but we ended up with Jeff.
No,
oh, come on, I'm kidding.
I know. We know you're kidding by default. Come on. What are you? So all of a sudden going to come. So become, I was at the beginning. You sounded like you were getting real serious. And I was like, what have you done with Larry? But your true colors have come out. And thank God. Silly guy. No, thank you, Larry, for phoning in. And I appreciate it.
Absolutely. It's fun to be on.
Thank you for that.
I didn't see you guys.
No problem. It's just. Consider it a favor to you.
And thank you. And also, Larry, thank you for writing the foreword to the book. It was very nice of you to do
pleasure.
So.
Great pleasure. I appreciate you asking because I really I do feel music is such an essential part of the cinematic experience. So I'm happy to help highlight it.
Thank you.
Great book.
Okay, everybody. Thanks so much.
Bye.
All right. Bye-bye. Well, okay, let's see. A jazz pianist makes a discovery days before the death of his wife that causes him to believe his 65-year marriage was a lie. He embarks on an exploration of his own past that brings him face-to-face with a menagerie of characters from a bygone era. Directed by Daniel Noah, Max Rose, in theaters today here in New York and other cities. It is co-starred by the beautiful, lovely Carrie Bechet, Dean Stockwell, Kevin Pollak, Ileana Douglas, Claire Bloom, Rance Howard. You know, it's just an astonishing. Mort Saal, I said. And Lee Weaver. It's an astonishing cast. Truly astonishing. Of course, at its center, Jerry Lewis. So let's get into this conversation with Daniel Noah. He's in, I believe he was in California calling in for this conversation. I should say, I'm in a car. Because, you know, I try to be in the studio as much as possible, but it's not always possible. So forgive anything like background noise or interferences of any kind. But this is my conversation with Daniel Noah, director of Max Rose.
I was just lying there listening to you breathe. And you breathe nicer than anyone I've ever known.
Abe and I were married 65 years. I can't even remember my life without her. But the truth is, her life with me was a lie.
Has something happened between you and Mom that you haven't told me or anyone?
Oh, her compact.
You're the secret in my heart, Ben.
I thought you gave it to her.
I wanted to ask you here because I thought it was really important for you to have some social interaction with your peers.
Max is a piano player.
Can you play the blues?
I live the blues.
You had your music. You had Mom. You guys somehow loved each other day in, day out for 65 years.
Didn't
I? Did
Hey, Daniel, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
All right, thank you. Thank you, Victoria. I don't know if she's surreptitiously in the background or not. What do you think?
She's on mute. She thinks I'm on mute.
Oh, okay, yeah. Nice to make your acquaintance, right? Daniel Noah, correct? And director of Max Rose.
Writer-director.
Writer-director, yeah. I beg your pardon. Well, now I know how you found this project. You invented it.
That's right. I found it in my unconscious.
I'm going to pretend I don't know a lot about your career, and I may be very convincing, but no, is this your first feature that you've directed as well?
I directed a very teeny tiny, what they call no-budget feature back in...
Oh, I'm familiar with those.
...which I consider to be a former life.
Right.
So really ostensibly my first film as a director.
Okay. This is the first one you're going to take ownership of.
Well, I'm proud of the other films.
Oh, good.
This one represents, you know, who I am today.
I got you.
The other one, like I said, feels like another person made it in some way.
I understand. Can you start us off with, you know, this is a podcast, but I have to sometimes step outside of myself and behave like I'm my audience's surrogate. And so I guess my first real question was, you got to share a Jerry Lewis story, some anecdote that encapsulates having met and worked with Jerry Lewis.
Well, I think the thing that most people seem to be interested in is, you know, what it was like to work with someone who is as iconic as he is and you know, was it intimidating or, you know, was like blinded by awe? And one of the benefits of how long it can sometimes take to put an independent film together is that it gives you time to prepare. And in this case, this was a film that was very difficult to get off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was, there's a widely held belief that, you know, you can't make movies about old people. There's no market for it. It's all wrong, but that, you know, that those were some of the barriers that we had to break through in order to get this movie put together. And so that afforded Jerry and me a great deal of time to just get to know each other. And so, you know, when I first met him at our very first meeting, he said to me, if this thing is going to work, we've got to love each other, and I'm going to start loving you right now. And he did. He really welcomed me into his home and into his family, and I would go visit him about once a month for the years that it took to get the movie going. And, but one of my favorite moments was this very surreal moment of being served lox and bagels by Jerry Lewis in our pajamas on a Sunday morning on his boat in San Diego, and just kind of realizing how much I had come to know the man as he is and not the man as he's understood.
Right.
And you know, how in many ways, because Max is based on my grandfather, I found myself kind of recreating that relationship with him.
Mm. Oh, and like,
very
okay.
Much still have that relationship with him.
Mm-hmm. And he was aware of that?
I didn't tell him that until mm-hmm. the movie was finished.
Oh.
I didn't tell him that Max was based on my grandfather because I wanted him to really own it and not feel like he was depicting someone else. So I wasn't sure how he was going to react, but he was very, very moved when I told him.
Was he? He seems to gravitate towards the sentimental, certainly a level of earnestness, and so maybe it was wise to sort of not share that at the onset.
Yeah, we'll never know. I know that one of the things that was really shocking and amazing was the parallels between Max's story and Jerry's story, like the real Jerry, were uncanny, and to the point where you would think I had known him intimately when I wrote the script. I remember him saying, you know, one of our early meetings, he said, you know, guy, you know, what are you, cameras in my house? Like, how do you know all these things about me? And, And I to this day, I can't explain how all of that happened. But obviously, he would take so much of himself in the role that I think it would have diluted the purity of that experience.
Right. Is it my, I don't know how much you can or want to talk about his physical limitations. It appeared that in terms of when I was observing the way the film was shot, that perhaps that was something you had to work with, that he was.
He was 87 when we shot it. Mm-hmm. You know, it was, this kind of gets back to one of those barriers that I talked about to putting the movie together was that we were often pitched casting younger, there were many incredible actors who were suggested, people I worship and would kill to work with, but who even in their 70s I felt would not honestly represent what the story is. It's about what is it like to really be that age. And we all talked very early on about neither glamorizing nor degradating the real true experience of being in one's late 80s. And so we were always very careful to just speak that in almost a documentary-like way. So, when you're in your late 80s, you're sitting down a lot. And when you do move around, you have to be a little more careful than you were.
I think when you're in your late 40s, you're sitting around a lot. frankly, I was super impressed. I was super impressed by just his performance. I really guess that's kudos to you as well. It was very, just it seemed like he was very present in the role. That was what I took away.
Yeah, I think so. Well, I don't know that he's even acting really.
Right.
Know?
Yeah.
I think he's really, in my opinion, this is really the first time he's allowed the real him to be seen by a camera.
Mm-hmm.
And people talk about Jerry Langford in King of Comedy being the real him. But really that, and I think even, Scorsese would acknowledge that is a caricature
of him. Yeah.
Version of one of Jerry's many facets. Jerry Langford is still very much, an idea of Jerry Lewis, the show business, a mogul.
And personality,
I think the first time that he really was not putting on a character in any way. He was just existing in front of the camera and existing in a truthful way with the other actors. There was really no artifice at all.
So, Daniel, what you're saying is you're a better director than Martin Scorsese, right? That's what you're saying, right?
you said that, and you are wrong.
Well, jury's out.
No, I said nothing. Nothing of the sort. King of Comedy is, by the way, easily my favorite Scorsese film. It's one of my favorite films of all time.
I'm actually feel the exact same way. I think it's my favorite Scorsese
film.
Yeah, I would say so because, it wears over time. It only gets richer and richer and more rewarding, watching it over and over. Wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I was at that.
Absolutely.
I was at that 40th anniversary Tribeca Film Festival screening and reunion of Taxi Driver. It may be the first time I saw that one on screen, but I remember going to the movie theater as a very, very young man. I want to emphasize very, very young. When I went to see The King of Comedy in the theater in 1982, I guess it was. I don't know. But it was incredible. Even then, I knew I was watching greatness, just all around.
Yeah.
So I can't imagine what you felt like when you found out that Jerry Lewis was going to be in the movie, that you got him in the movie.
I cried like a little baby when I got the call. Yeah, it was, I think there are very few moments in one's life where you're aware at the time that one of the most important events of your existence is taking place, and that was one of them for me.
Mm. And so it's opening. Is it true? It's coming out on this. Is it coming out on the 2nd?
Yeah, it opens in New York at Sunshine September 2nd, and then it opens in LA at a bunch of theaters September 9th, and then throughout September and October, it will roll out throughout the nation.
Yeah, and is Jerry kind of, is he supporting the film on any level? Is he able to? I mean, I assume that he's a busy guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. He's proud of it?
Right now, you know, we're both, he's so, so happy with it. Yes. It's very, very important to him.
Is he traveling to you?
He's out there something. What was that?
Oh, I was just wondering if you guys were going to be in New York City, maybe making some appearances.
Yeah, we may. I'm not sure yet what the New York plans are, but yeah, we'll be getting out there at some point.
Very good. Well, I hope at some future time that you'll, you know, maybe if you're in New York City, you'll look me up and let me know, because it would be great. I do the podcast normally out of a studio, and I would love it if you got the full experience at some point, but, you know, be great.
I would love to.
Yeah, but I really was excited to see it. I mean, Mort Saul, can you also just mention how that happened, Mort Saul? I mean, he's one of the, you know, he's such an icon of comedy, and I don't remember the last time I saw him in anything, you know, like this, anyway.
Yeah. Well, he's really, you know, he barely did, you know, he wasn't in films, really.
Right.
He did a tremendous amount behind the scenes in films that people are largely unaware of. You know, he was a ghostwriter. I mean, I don't think I'm allowed to say, but if I told you some of the movies or iconic scenes and iconic films that he secretly wrote, your jaw would be on the floor.
Yeah?
Yeah, Mort, you know, God, what?
Citizen Kane.
What's that?
I said Citizen Kane, but I was just joking.
Yeah, it was actually him as Kane. So, Mort is such an amazing man, and honestly, just getting to know all of the older cast on this movie, and including, you know, some that I wasn't able to cast, you know, who I got a chance to get to know just during the casting, was unbelievably exciting for someone like me, who really had just, I've always really worshipped the golden era of entertainment.
Sure.
And studied it and revered it, and so to get to meet some of these people, let alone actually work with them, it was absolutely surreal, and Mort is, I maintain, one of the most vitally important figures in American culture for the time that he was alive, and is largely unknown in terms of, you know, what his story is not one that's widely known.
Yeah.
But he is truly the father of modern. The way he put himself on the line.
Sure, a political comedy and commentary. Yeah, I was gonna ask you if he had pulled out a newspaper and started riffing at any point, because that was what he was best known for, right? Getting on the stage and improvising from the newspaper, I believe. Did Mort and Jerry know each other? Because they are contemporaries, right?
They'd met in passing, but I don't think they'd actually seen each other in decades. No.
Yeah. So Kevin Pollak is in it, and a lot of comedians elbowing each other out of the camera.
Eliana Douglas,
Eliana, one of my favorite actresses. I'd love to get her. It's a long. I could waste a lot of time saying all the people that I covet for this podcast, but she is definitely up there on the top of the list. And anyway, the name of the movie is called Max Rose. It's directed by Daniel Noah. And stars the youthful Jerry Lewis. Yeah, it's opening in New York on September 2nd at the Landmark Sunshine, or the Sunshine Landmark, whatever, in New York City. Thank you so much, by the way.
Thank you.
I wish you a lot of luck with the film and future projects.
Thank you so much. Well, it was a pleasure to speak. I look forward to meeting you in New York.
Okay, I'll make sure you get a link to this, although you've already, of course, experienced it, so...
True. I always love listening to myself and cringing.
Well, you may like the podcast anyway, because it does have a lot of... I do get a lot of great guests on here. I mean, I'm like yourself. So maybe it's something you might enjoy. But thanks again, Daniel. I appreciate it.
Okay.
All right. Take care. Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to episode 367. You know, on the next episode, let's see what we got coming up here. On the next episode,
We have the filmmaker of a new documentary. It's currently out. It's called Author, the J.T. Leroy story. If you're really plugged into the pop culture, you might be aware of this story. It's fascinating. This author, J.T. Leroy, wrote all these books of fiction based on his life, which was about his horrific upbringing and his difficult life, you know, very dramatic. And it turns out that J.T. Leroy doesn't really exist. He is a woman named Laura Albert. And when this story broke by the New York Times, you know, it was a big deal. And J.T. Leroy was not just Laura as a... She actually had this other person go around as J.T. Leroy for her, like an avatar. And so when the story was uncovered, of course, it changed everything up. And this is essentially Laura's version of the story as she tells it directly and joined by many people in her life who knew her. So it's a fascinating story about gender, about identity, about truth. It's very, very interesting. It's a fascinating story told really beautifully in this documentary called The Author, the J.T. Leroy Story, which I believe premiered at Sundance and is opening and is available now in cities around the country. So I urge you to go see it. But in the meantime, we're going to have on the filmmaker Jeff Feuerzeig, and Laura Albert herself will be joining me on the next episode. Also coming up in the next episode or two, we have my conversation with actor Paul Lazar returning again. I've been putting this off, but I may be putting this very soon. Is Tom Noonan back? Conversation. And finally, recorded a nice long chat with Whit Stillman. You know, he's on a number of episodes ago. It didn't come out very well at all. It was very frustrating. But I did put it up for you because I felt like I didn't know if I'd get Whit back on the show. Well, what a gentleman. He sat down with me just a couple of days ago, and we knocked out a long conversation. It was a lot of fun, and I'll be putting that up shortly because his latest movie, Love and Friendship, comes out on platforms. It's currently out, I think, on demand, but it will be coming out on Blu-ray and DVD on the 6th of September, just a matter of days. So we're going to get that episode up next, actually. Thank you, everybody. I'm going to sign off here. You hopefully are a subscriber. Go to iTunes. Leave us a rating, a star rating, please. Leave us a comment on that. It's very important. If you haven't done so and you listen to the show, that's a Shonda. You need to help me out. It's a very little request, very small request. Just go to iTunes and take care of that for me. Much appreciated. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/filmwaxradio. We're on, you can find us on Twitter and on Instagram. You can visit filmwaxradio.com and find out what's going on with the show and much, much more. So listen, see you around at the festivals. All right, take care, everybody. Until next time.